Hey everyone, I'm Arun Venugopal in for Melissa Harris-Perry today, and you're listening to The Takeaway. It's good to have you with us. And we're wishing our friends down along the Gulf Coast some love and luck today. Hurricane Ida hit the region really hard over the weekend. We're watching the updates along with y'all. Obviously, we'll be talking about the impact of the storm this week as we get a better sense of what we're looking at. But we are feeling for you, Louisiana. If you're hearing us and have power and can give us a sense of what you're seeing and feeling down there, our number is 877-869-8253. But more important, we're wishing you the best right now. With that in mind, we have a lot of other news to get to today, and we start with a story that will definitely be impacting the Gulf Coast region in the wake of these storms. For months now, the Biden administration has been extending a federal eviction moratorium to protect tenants struggling to pay their rent during the pandemic. But now the moratorium is over. Really, truly over. That's because the Supreme Court ruled last week that the CDC has overstepped its authority and that for the moratorium to continue, Congress would need to authorize it. But that's unlikely to happen, as White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters on Friday.
What we're trying to do here is prevent people from being evicted from their homes. If there were enough votes to pass an eviction moratorium in Congress, it would have happened. It hasn't happened.
And while the White House says it's working with states on solutions, hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of tenants across the country are now at risk of losing their homes, including tenants in the state of New York, where more than 830,000 households are behind on their rent. We're joined today by Sia Weaver, campaign coordinator of Housing Justice for All in New York. Sia, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Peter Hepburn, assistant professor of sociology at Rutgers University, Newark, and part of the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Sia, from your perch, what's the significance of this Supreme Court ruling?
Well, it's really just devastating. As you said, 830,000 households or more really are behind on rent in New York, and 77% of them are people of color. The thing that's the most painful about all of this is our state also has $2.7 billion in rental assistance money meant to solve this problem, and we've been unable to spend it. So this is a real wave of evictions that should be preventable, but for some reason has not been prevented.
Yeah, and let's get back to the failings of the state in that regard in a bit. Peter, what has the administration's position been so far on the eviction moratoriums?
You know, I think they were certainly very concerned at the end of July about the potential of extending it and then having it struck down with the understanding that Justice Kavanaugh had issued an opinion earlier this summer suggesting that he was, you know, they were basically allowing the moratorium to stay in place temporarily with the understanding that it wouldn't be extended. And that's what sort of led to the confusion at the end of July and the beginning of August when the moratorium briefly lapsed and then a sort of new version of it was extended. So I think they were expecting this to happen and knew that they were only buying a few extra weeks with the last extension.
And the president himself indicated that he didn't think it was going to hold up to scrutiny. What's your take on that? Did you think that he was correct in that?
It certainly appears that he was. I'm not a legal scholar. I can't speak to the Supreme Court's reasoning on this, but certainly the justices had tipped their hand that this was unlikely to survive further scrutiny, and indeed it did not.
See, what kind of eviction protections have been in place during the pandemic here in New York?
In New York State, we have benefited from a very strong eviction moratorium that has protected thousands of households from losing their homes in the middle of the pandemic. So tenants have been able to file a declaration of hardship, effectively preventing any eviction from moving forward in the state of New York. And we think that this has been critical, not just for keeping people housed, but for preventing the spread of COVID-19 and making sure that people can stay healthy during the pandemic.
Now, one tenant representative I spoke to a few weeks ago said that, you know, a lot of this hangs on whether people actually know about these protections. Are we seeing a problem of people just self-evicting and, you know, putting themselves out there?
Yeah, absolutely. To put some numbers on that, for example, of those 830,000 households who are behind on rent, only about 170,000 of them have actually applied for rental assistance. either because they don't know about it or because of some fear or reluctance. And if you're in that situation, you're very likely to simply be bullied out of your home.
And so then what happens? What are you seeing in terms of when people feel like they have no recourse? Where do they go?
Well, you know, it's really hard to say. Some enter the shelter system. Some go to live with families. They double or triple up. Some, you know, they just, they disappear. We don't know what happens. Households that are self-evicting, that are choosing not to interact with the vast network of affordable housing advocates and social service providers that exist in New York, we don't know what happens to them. And it's terrifying. It's heartbreaking.
And that's here in New York. Peter, what are you seeing in terms of the national landscape?
Yeah, I think it's a similar picture, but without many of the resources and supports that we're able to offer here in the city. So, you know, if you're going through this process in Greenville, South Carolina, you maybe don't have that network of resources that's available and the sort of outreach to people who are potentially at risk of losing their homes. And I think that's going to make the whole process that much harder. And, you know, this is happening at a time when, you know, rents are increasing across the country and the availability of affordable housing has never been more limited. And that means that people who are losing their homes right now are going to have fewer and fewer options available to them. And with that mark of an eviction on your record, you're going to end up settling for, you know, worse housing in a worse neighborhood.
So that's something that actually tracks you over the course of your life. If it happens once, it's not something you can shake off.
No, it's very hard to do that. And, you know, in the case of, you know, a credit report, you have the possibility of going and trying to correct the record. With evictions and with a tenant history, there's no way to correct an incorrect record either. So even a filing that hasn't resulted in an eviction can follow you for quite a long time.
Now, Peter, I know you're not a legal scholar, but to the extent you understand it, the Supreme Court's decision, it was split down ideological lines, correct? What did the minority have to say in terms of trying to extend the moratorium?
You know, the minority appeared to be very cognizant of current public health conditions and concerned about the possibility that a wave of eviction filings and evictions could lead to further spread of COVID-19. And, you know, I think there were a number of good studies that were conducted summer of 2020 and were throughout last year showing that when state level moratoria ended and you saw evictions pick up in those localities, that COVID-19 cases also increased at the same time. And there's a good argument to be made that the sort of doubled up, tripled up housing that Sia was talking about, or the, you know, increased use of homeless shelters, those are exactly the sort of circumstances that don't allow for social distancing and that encourage the spread of COVID-19.
And the court rule basically, it was basically the liberal wing of the court, which was trying to extend it. New York's own eviction moratorium had had a run in as well with the Supreme Court recently. What happened there?
Yeah, it was slightly different. In the federal moratorium, the Supreme Court essentially ruled that the CDC had overstepped its authority. When it came to the New York moratorium, what the court said is that because landlords were not given a chance to challenge the hardship declaration that tenants could file, that landlords were not being awarded a due process. So that's almost, in some ways, I think that's almost worse, right? Because what they're saying with the New York moratorium is actually that the moratorium shouldn't be in place at all. And that's just really terrifying when we know it's something that, as Peter has said, is saving lives during a pandemic and is preventing people from the lifelong negative impacts that an eviction can cause. We're hopeful that in New York State, our legislature is going to reconvene this week, address the weaknesses of our moratorium that the Supreme Court raised, and put hopefully some new protections in place.
Now, Peter, the Supreme Court's ruling was just a few days ago, but to your knowledge, are we already seeing people get evicted across the country?
So there was a significant backlog of cases in some jurisdictions where, you know, the CDC moratorium that had been in place allowed cases to be filed, and some jurisdictions were conducting hearings. Some were even continuing to issue evictions despite the moratorium. What I'm concerned about, you know, today, tomorrow, is that there are going to be jurisdictions that have gotten cases all the way up to the judgment stage and just haven't issued writs, haven't sent sheriffs out to actually evict people. But I think we could be seeing that in some places, you know, as early as today. And then over the coming days and weeks, I'm concerned that we will see a big upsurge in the number of cases that are being filed. You know, these are the cases that landlords held off on filing over the course of the last 11 months when the CDC moratorium was in place. And, you know, especially in areas where the dispersal of emergency rental assistance has been slow, and I think we're going to see a big jump in the number of cases that are being filed. There are places where if you have applied for rental assistance, that case can't move forward. And there are still states that have state level protections in place. And hopefully New York rejoins that list this week. But the protections right now are as few as we've seen since the start of the pandemic.
And are you particularly worried about certain parts of the country that might have, stronger real estate lobbies, landlord lobbies, people who are just really pushing for these evictions to start ramping up?
Absolutely. You know, there were broad variations in landlord-tenant law across the country prior to the pandemic. And we know that there are some states where it's, you know, riskier to be a tenant than others. So, you know, if you're in Houston, you have fewer protections against eviction under normal circumstances than you do, you know, here in New York. And I think places like Florida, like Georgia, Ohio, and Texas, where that don't have a lot of protections normally, those are places that we could see a big upswing in eviction cases very, very quickly.
Peter, is Congress planning to step in and do its job? I mean, what's likely to happen on the federal front?
I would be surprised if there was congressional action at the federal level at this point. If there were votes for this in Congress, we would have seen action already. And I just don't think that's going to happen, which means that at this point, it's up to the states.
What's with this inaction in Congress? Why are they not addressing this?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to recognize that there was, you know, there were a tremendous number of eviction cases occurring in this country prior to the pandemic. You know, so in 2016, there were 3.7 million eviction cases filed in this country. Over the last 11 months, with the CDC moratorium in place, there have been half as many as we would normally expect. We have seen policy responses that have helped to keep the sort of the overall number of eviction cases much lower than normal. And Congress has taken action to appropriate over $46 billion in emergency rental assistance, which is, you know, a vast sum of money. You know, we're talking there nearly the annual budget of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And there has been action, but I think now there, especially with the Supreme Court's decision, the options that are available to the administration are limited, and Congress's willingness to take on this issue is apparently pretty limited as well.
Sia, let's get back to the issue of New York State and what seems to be the inaction of the Assembly, the legislature, that is, to step in and really offer resources. What would that look like, and why hasn't that really kicked in so far?
Well, I am hopeful that this week, with a new governor and the legislature returning to session for the first time since June, we will see some movement on increasing eviction protections for renters during the pandemic and getting rental assistance money out the door. So in New York, we're also quite lucky, right? Because we, before the pandemic, had some of the most robust tenant protections in the country, tenant protections that were hard fought for and hard to win. So we are in a better place than most here in New York, and it's still not a really good place. So we'll see what happens this week when the legislature reconvenes and what our new governor is willing to do.
And our new governor would be Kathy Hochul, who replaced Andrew Cuomo just a couple weeks ago. And what sort of messages has she offered on this issue?
Well, this is really the first issue that has come across her desk. I mean, she was just appointed governor early last week, and what she inherited was a longstanding housing crisis with 92,000 New Yorkers homeless, hundreds of thousands behind on rent, and a completely colossal failure of a rental assistance program. So from the jump, she has been confronted every single day with this crisis. And you know, I think that she knows that she's going to have to take action and do something different to really turn the page on this COVID-19 rent debt crisis.
All right. No honeymoon period for our first woman governor. Let's hear from a landlord representative now. This is Jay Martin of the Community Housing Improvement Program, or CHIP. He represents several thousand building owners.
There are many procedures put in place to protect tenants, to allow them to apply for this fund, to delay the eviction proceedings. Property owners are not in the process of wanting to throw people out during a global pandemic. They're simply requiring funds to keep the housing that they're providing for free functioning. There has been no delay in their property taxes. There's been no delay on their mortgage payments due. All those arrears and all those ability to defer their mortgage payments, that's gone, over with. They still have to pay their mortgages. They still have to pay their property taxes. So the only way that they can continue to function from a legal and business perspective is to file these eviction paperwork proceedings.
So, Sia, help me understand this. On one hand, he's saying that that basically that landlords are put in the awkward position having to keep on paying making their mortgage payments and their property taxes. On the other hand, he's saying this is more of a formality. We're not looking at this sort of like this deluge of eviction proceedings. Let's take the first part before we get to the second one. Are landlords, in fact, in an awkward position of having to keep on doing this? And why is that, you know, given that we're almost a year and a half into this pandemic?
Yeah, so the reality is that New York's eviction moratorium both includes an eviction moratorium and a foreclosure moratorium. So the fact that landlords have no protections during this moment is simply false. They have the same ability to defer payments as renters do. And again, an eviction moratorium doesn't mean that the rent is not eventually due. It just means that as the pandemic proceeds, you're not going to be taken to court for that back rent. And so landlords are actually in the same boat vis-a-vis their mortgage payments here in New York State. And that part of the moratorium, the foreclosure moratorium, was not struck down, and that is still in place. So that's just important to note here. The second thing to note is that landlords are just in a much stronger financial position than renters on the whole, by virtue of the fact that they own property. They are able to get access to equity. They're able to get access to savings and wealth that renters on the whole largely don't have. I'm sure Peter could say more about this just in general, but landlords are much more financially stable than renters, and it's somewhat insulting to be told that that's simply not true.
Peter, you want to weigh in there?
Yeah, you know, I agree with C entirely that, you know, the typical renter in this country has little or nothing in the way of savings to rely on, whereas the typical landlord obviously has the wherewithal to purchase and hopefully maintain an apartment building. There's a vast difference between those two positions. And while there have been obviously considerable delays, especially here in New York, with the dispersal of emergency rental assistance, the money that is out there and that is available should be more than enough to make up for the full rental arrearages that we've seen in this country over the course of the pandemic. You know, it's not as though the money isn't there and that money won't be going to landlords. You know, the financial case for needing to file an eviction right now is pretty weak.
Sia, real quick, are we likely to see lots of people out on the street in the coming months or a year from now?
I certainly hope not. We are going to fight as hard as we can to prevent that from happening. And that means increasing outreach to sign people up for rental assistance. It means fighting harder in the legislature than ever before to extend eviction protections and making sure that tenants know their rights. But I think what Peter raised earlier about the crisis of eviction that existed in this country and in the state before the pandemic is the thing that's hanging over all of our heads. Prior to the eviction, over 100, or the eviction moratoriums, over 100 people were evicted in New York State every single day. And those are just the evictions that happened in the court. Lots and lots of people self-evict. So we are certainly, certainly afraid of the long-term crisis of poverty that the pandemic has caused and people's long-term ability to pay their rent. You know, it's not just emergency rental assistance that we need. The fact is many, many, many more people are unemployed. Many, many, many more people are now underemployed and unable to afford their rent. So this crisis is going to have lasting impacts beyond what these emergency interventions like emergency rental assistance and eviction moratoriums can really solve for.
Sia Weaver is a campaign coordinator of Housing Justice for All in New York. Peter Hepburn is an assistant professor of sociology at Rutgers University Newark and part of the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amid the chaotic evacuation of U.S. troops and allies from Afghanistan, the State Department has prepared to bring around 50,000 Afghan refugees into the U.S. for resettlement. Some conservatives have criticized the plans despite the intense security checks that are required for refugees prior to relocating within the U.S. But in the face of those partisan complaints, refugee agencies in states across the country have already started the complicated resettlement process for recent Afghan arrivals. Joining me now to discuss this process is Russell Smith, CEO of Refugee Services of Texas. Thanks for being here, Russell.
Thank you very much.
So when were agencies like yours first made aware that you'd need to prepare to resettle this group of refugees from Afghanistan?
There's actually the Special Immigrant Visa Program has actually been around for about a dozen years. And we have been welcoming Iraqis and Afghans who've helped the U.S. overseas for that time. However, kind of this the current situation has accelerated all of that. And instead of the normal 10,000 or so that the whole country sees in a year, we're seeing about 25,000 of them over a very short period of time. And so it's been probably like 3 or 4 weeks that we started hearing about it and started seeing them arrive.
And so what does that mean for your organization specifically when it comes to logistics?
Typically, when we get a refugee family or an SIV family, we'll have a couple of weeks notice. We'll put together a welcome team. They'll set up an apartment. They'll pick them up at the airport and get them all set up. And typically that, you know, it's a 1 to 2 week lead time. We're getting sometimes, you know, 4 hours lead time, sometimes 8 hours lead time. So it's kind of all hands on deck. Our staff are picking them up. We are putting some families up in hotels until we can get apartments set up. So it's just a little bit, you know, a time crunch. But, you know, this is what we've done for 40 years and as Refugee Services of Texas. So, you know, we've got the skill set to do it.
So let's address this concern that some conservatives say, you know, argue that Afghan refugees present a potential security risk if they're allowed to enter the U.S. Is there?
I would say absolutely not. These are so refugees in general are the most vetted population ever. They go through a tremendous amount of security checks. They go through multiple agencies, health checks. And specifically, the people we're talking about are the ones that have helped us as translators, as guides, as people that have worked with the U.S. military overseas. And we've made a promise to them to help them and to ensure that they are, you know, are able to come here and not be put in harm's way. So I'd say absolutely not. This, especially this group, you know, refugees in general are very well vetted. And the SIVs are, you know, these are people just escaping with their lives that have, you know, we made a promise to because they stepped up and helped us. And I believe that it's not only are they not a security risk, but they are, you know, we have kind of the moral obligation to help them find a new home.
Russell, your organization was founded in the 1970s when we saw hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing Vietnam. What, if anything, have we learned since then?
The refugee program itself is a tremendous way for this country to do multiple things. It helps alleviate global hotspots, right? So you pointed out Vietnam. You know, we had a huge influx of Serbs, Croatians, and Bosnians when Yugoslavia broke up. You know, it actually, the kind of the modern refugee movement started after World War II with Jews fleeing from Europe. So it really kind of reflects the world as it is. And what it does is help alleviate crisis situations. It spreads our diplomacy. It actually brings people in that give kind of a rich texture to our communities. It helps our economy. Study after study shows that like refugee resettlement is a net benefit in multiple ways to the U.S. and to local economies and to local communities.
And what's the most important thing in terms of acclimating a family of refugees to a local community to make sure that they are integrated and that they're welcome?
Yeah, so we do a lot of work with the community to ensure that they understand kind of what resettlement entails. We work with the local school systems, the local social services, and make sure that people understand kind of what, you know, the people that are coming and that there are sufficient resources for language, for jobs, for housing. And so just ensuring that the community is on board, and you know that's a continuous process, and that there are sufficient resources to welcome new people into the community.
And on that local level, what are the ways that people can be helpful when refugees do show up in their communities?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, so if they're in Texas, they can go to our website at rstx.org, and we have volunteer opportunities. We have ways of, you know, getting involved in multiple ways. And RST is in Austin, Houston, Dallas, Fort Worth, Amarillo, and down in the Rio Grande Valley. But every community pretty much has at least one refugee resettlement agency. So there are multiple agencies across the country that do this work. And I'd say just kind of contact them. Find ways to get involved. One of the best volunteer experiences that I, like when I started, I did some of the volunteer work here. I went and greeted a family at the airport as they were arriving. And that is a tremendously moving experience, just seeing that, you know, these people who have been in a refugee camp, they fled violence and oppression, and they're just arriving at this completely new place that is Texas, just about to start a new life. So I recommend that, but there are other opportunities as well.
And you mentioned earlier on that many of these people have served as translators or have worked in other capacities with the U.S. government or military. Do those skill sets in some ways help them prepare for life in the U.S.?
Absolutely. You know, the SIVs that we resettle typically speak English. They typically have kind of maybe a different skill set than the others that have that are coming as refugees from other countries. I'll tell you that, like in our agency, we have over 200 employees, and about half are former refugees or SIVs. And I was kind of looking through our staff list the other day, and there are a significant number of our supervisors and people in higher level positions that are special immigrant visas holders from Iraq and Afghanistan. So they come with leadership skills, they come with English skills. Like other refugees, they come with a drive to kind of make a new life.
Russell Smith is the CEO of Refugee Services of Texas. Russell, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Arun Vanagopal in for Melissa Harris Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Imagine being taken from the only family you've ever known. You're then placed with a family that knows nothing about you or your culture, and your birth family can do nothing about it. This is not the beginning of some awful movie, but the reality faced by countless Indigenous and Native families. According to the National Indian Child Welfare Association, up to 35% of Native children were removed from their families by state child welfare and private adoption agencies. That was until 1978, when the Indian Child Welfare Act was enacted and mandated federal requirements that protect the interests of the Native child, their family, and their tribe. The podcast This Land from Crooked Media focuses on a federal challenge to the law in their latest season.
Shockwaves are going through the Native American community. That's after a federal judge calls landmark legislation involving Native American adoption illegal.
For the past 4 years, I've been following one case that's now sitting on the steps of the Supreme Court. How did this small step towards addressing generations of family separation become a target?
Melissa Harris Perry recently spoke to Rebecca Nagel, journalist and host of This Land.
We are telling the story of one case. It's a federal lawsuit, and it started when a white couple living in the suburbs of Fort Worth wanted to adopt a Native American toddler, but that child's tribe, Navajo Nation, had identified a Navajo home, and a federal law called the Indian Child Welfare Act said that's where the child should go. And so the white couple sued, and they didn't only sue to get custody of the child, which they actually won and rather quickly, but they filed a federal lawsuit to try and strike ICWA down. We're still waiting to see if the Supreme Court will take that lawsuit. It's likely. And it's a lawsuit that threatens not only the future of this one law, but the legal structure defending tribes and the rights of tribal nations.
Let me take just one more beat on this particular story. So these potential adoptive parents actually were able to adopt the child. Why did they feel a desire and interest in addressing this particular policy, this law?
That's a really, really, really good question. The story that they tell publicly is that they filed the federal lawsuit at a time when it looked like they weren't going to win custody and the law was threatening to tear their family apart. But we were actually, in our reporting, able to piece together a timeline. And they actually filed the federal lawsuit the same week the child's tribes agreed to the adoption. And so they basically filed the lawsuit right before the path was cleared for them to adopt. And so it's a really good question. There's actually, the Brackeens are the namesake and the lead plaintiffs in the case. And there are actually three non-Native foster families who are part of the lawsuit. Two of those foster families successfully adopted the Native child in question. So why they pursued this lawsuit is a really good question.
All right, let's back up a little bit so that we can kind of move up to the moment of this case. Why was there even a need for the Indian Child Welfare Act? What's behind it?
So before ICWA passed, like you mentioned up top, an estimated 25 to 35% of Native kids had been removed from their tribes and from their families. And two things were going on. One, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was actually running a program called the Federal Indian Adoption Project to purposely take Native children away from their families and place them for adoption in white homes. And the second thing that was happening was racism in child welfare agencies that were looking at, you know, Native children being raised by a grandma and other things that are really common in Indigenous communities and saying that that was those parents or those families were unfit and taking the children. And so ICWA passed in 1978. And I think you can really think of it, too, as coming in a wave of civil rights legislations that we saw in the 60s and 70s that looked at racist and abusive practices that were happening in states. And Congress put measures in place to prevent that from happening. And ICWA was one of those measures to protect Native families and to prevent family separation in Native communities.
It's a stunning reminder that, you know, there was obviously a moral, emotional, political, ideological outcry in recent years when we've talked about family separation at the border relative to migrants coming in through the U.S. southern border. But it is a reminder that family separation was not a brand new policy at all in the U.S.
Absolutely. The United States government has been systematically separating Native children from their families for generations. And so in the late 1800s, the United States started rounding up Native children and forcing them to go to boarding schools, which were really assimilation camps. And the explicit goal of those schools was to separate Native children from their tribes and from their culture so that eventually there would no longer be Native people. The same goal was part of the Indian Adoption Project, the idea being just that Native children were simply better off in white homes. And I would argue that it's still happening today. You know, racial disparities for Native children and for Black children within foster care is shocking. We looked at one case that happened in Minneapolis. And in Minneapolis, Native kids are 35 times more likely to be removed from their families than white children. In the state of Minnesota, 1 in 3 Native kids before they turn 18 will enter foster care, and Native babies, 1 in 10 Native babies will enter foster care before their first birthday. For white babies that age, the rate is 1 in 100. And the majority of these kids are not being removed for allegations of abuse. The underlying things are neglect. And so this nebulous category of neglect is sweeping up disproportionate numbers of children who come from families that are poor and families of color.
Right. Neglect is often kind of a catch-all phrase for meaning poverty.
Exactly. Exactly. And instead of, you know, and you can really see it in the stories that we tell this season, we go in depth in some of the stories that happened that precipitated this case. But like in one custody case, you know, a grandma had to fight the child welfare system for 3 years and then fight the white foster family that had her grandchild for about 1.5 years for another 3 years to finally be able to adopt her grandchild. And, you know, the circumstances that led to her grandchild going into foster care in the first place was just that the family became homeless. And, you know, you can look at their story and see if that had never happened, that child probably would not have spent all that time in the system.
But it does feel like, again, if we're talking about litigants who are able to successfully adopt in their individual case, that there still might be something going on here about presumptions of some kinds of families, maybe heterosexual, two-parent, married, you know, middle income or higher families as being inherently better for children. Do we actually know anything about what is inherently better for children relative to their life outcomes?
Yeah, so all the data shows that all children do better when they stay with family. And so children in foster care who are in what people call like a kinship placement are less likely actually to experience abuse and neglect while they're in the system. And even studies have traced them, like followed those children into adulthood, and those children have better outcomes. And so ICWA, which was passed in 1978, which is actually really ahead of its time because it prioritizes first placing children with family, then placing children with other tribal members, and then placing children in other Native homes. And child welfare policy across the board has really started to look more and more and more like ICWA. And I would say that there is a deep class bias, and you can find out, you know, I spent hours going through the transcripts of the actual underlying custody cases behind this federal lawsuit. And, you know, one of the foster fathers, you know, made an argument that he was a better home for a child because he had more bedrooms in his house. And he was worried that her aunt had too small of a house and she wouldn't have privacy. Another foster dad in one of these cases said that the grandmother shouldn't have custody because since the child had moved in with her grandmother, she looked heavier. And so he talked about the body size of a 7-year-old as a reason why he should have custody. And so all those messages around class are deeply embedded in these cases.
How is it that you found these stories in order to follow them? And I actually have an image of you in my head of sitting here reading, you know, kind of pouring through these cases and these arguments. But what was the initial spark? How'd you find them?
Well, so this case threatens the legal structure defending tribal sovereignty. And so in the lawsuit, they're not just arguing that the Indian Child Welfare Act, this, you know, piece of legislation that's really important for Native families. They're not just arguing that that should go away. It's this kind of tricky legal argument, but they're basically saying that ICWA is based on race and therefore it discriminates. You know, it's a disadvantage to these white foster parents. It's not fair to the Native kid and it should go away because it discriminates based on race. But there are a ton of laws, everything from healthcare to tribal self-governance to Indian gaming, where tribal nations, indigenous nations, and tribal citizens are treated differently, not based on race, but because of our unique political status and our treaty relationship with the United States government. And so the scary thing about this federal lawsuit is if ICWA is unconstitutional because it's based on race, well, what about the hospital where I'm going to go this afternoon for a doctor's appointment? Like, if you went to that hospital, if you're not enrolled in a few tribes that are here in northeastern Oklahoma, they would turn you away. So how is ICWA racial discrimination, but that hospital constitutional?
And you suspect, or the podcast suspects, that maybe that's sort of the ultimate goal here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we need to look at these cases like we would look at any other federal lawsuit. If there was a federal lawsuit threatening, say, reproductive rights and Roe v. Wade, we wouldn't pick apart the details of one abortion case. We would see it as a threat to Roe v. Wade. And what journalists and what the media, and I would say even sometimes the courts, have failed to do with these lawsuits is just look at the legal arguments that are being made and what are the implications of those legal arguments. And we can even look at the lawyers behind this case and see where else they've made it. They've made the same argument to try and stop tribal casinos from opening, the exact same argument. And so without giving too much of what we get into in the season, further in the season, is that, you know, we found economic ties between the lawyers who are bringing these lawsuits. And we also, through FOIAs and actually through a hack that was very convenient for our journalism, a paper trail of people behind these cases talking about how they're for the benefit of states' rights and building conservative power.
But Rebecca, now I feel like we're about to go into this whole other land, which is, can the courts ever bring justice, right? Because the courts are always, right, it's that individual story. It's how do I rule in this case? It is sort of this micro focus when, of course, it is happening within this broader network. But that's almost like why we need legislation rather than courts making a decision like this. It makes me a bit nervous, just sort of knowing, again, the kind of fundamental narrow individual sort of way that courts typically tend to adjudicate cases.
I think this case and the story of this case and what we found in our investigation touches on these big questions about our democracy. In this case, the majority of U.S. states and the District of Columbia came out publicly supporting ICWA. The overwhelming majority of Native nations support this law. And there's basically a handful of adoption attorneys, corporate lawyers, and right-wing organizations and operatives, and six non-Native foster parents who've decided that it should go away. And if that argument was decided democratically, like, they wouldn't even get a vote. You know, they don't have the support and the base, but because they're using the federal court system, they're dangerously close to overturning a 40-year-old law. And I think we need to be talking about, as a society, is this really the role of the courts, or is it corrosive to our democracy?
And although it might seem almost obvious, I just want you to walk us through it for a moment. What difference does it make if tribal sovereignty is either lost or eroded?
Yeah, so there's a whole host of laws that treat people differently because they're citizens of a tribe, or treat tribal nations differently. And that goes all the way back to the beginning of the United States. And so tribes are sovereign nations. You know, we predate the United States. And so that sovereignty isn't something that the U.S. granted us. It's something that's actually inherent. And so our right to govern our citizens, our land, our languages, our culture, we need to be able to exercise that sovereignty if we're going to protect those things for future generations. And so that's kind of what's scary about this case, is that it could have a domino effect where, you know, this case is sort of the first thread that's pulled on a sweater that really undermines the legal structure defending tribes. And I think it's an easy thread for people to pull, because most people don't really know what a federally recognized tribe is, and they don't really understand the law behind treaties, and they don't know what ICWA is, or NAGPRA, or the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. Like, all of these things are kind of new concepts for a lot of people. And so you can make a lot of radical arguments about tribes and tribal sovereignty, and people don't realize how radical they are.
Given the nature of the sovereignty, could tribal courts simply rule differently? I mean, is that basically a declaration of war? I mean, I'm not trying to be silly here. I'm trying to really think through the obvious challenges of sovereignty. And of course, because the title is this land, right? It is sovereignty, but also it is this adjacent and internal land space, which makes nationhood and state building quite difficult.
Yeah, so this is how I think of tribal sovereignty. Like I said, it's inherent, but of course it's been impacted by colonization. And it's something that generations of Native people, you know, we've had to advocate, negotiate, and carve out spaces for our tribes to still have rights and to still exist. You know, we're not supposed to be here. We're here because we pushed back. And so, yeah, I mean, and that's, I think that's one of the other things that people who don't like the Indian Child Welfare Act don't like, because it gives tribes the right to intervene in child welfare cases. So just like, you know, I live here in Cherokee County in Oklahoma, and if I were a child, you know, the state of Oklahoma or my county could have a say in how a child welfare case goes. Well, tribes also have an invested interest in our children. And that's one thing that ICWA opponents really don't like, is that tribes can have a say in child welfare and adoption proceedings. And so there is this sort of, I think, fundamental lack of understanding of tribal sovereignty, and then also respect for tribal sovereignty, you know, and a recognition that tribes, you know, just like a state or just like a county, should be able to have a say in what's happening to their citizens.
I have so many more questions. We could be here all afternoon, but apparently I'm not allowed to do that. Rebecca Nagel, journalist and host of This Land, the award-winning documentary podcast. Rebecca is also a citizen of Cherokee Nation. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our show today, but before we go, we do want to note the damage that parts of Louisiana underwent this weekend when Hurricane Ida made landfall on Sunday as a Category 4 storm. Obviously, there are all sorts of power issues happening, some of which may not be fixed for days. The wind and storm surge damaged buildings, and we know lives have already been lost from the storm. This happened 16 years to the day that Hurricane Katrina decimated Louisiana. If you're listening from an area impacted by the hurricane, we hope you and your loved ones have been able to stay safe. We'll be bringing you more coverage on the aftermath of Hurricane Ida during tomorrow's show and throughout the week. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Vanigopal in for Melissa Harris-Perry. She's back with you tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.